is Ariel Ennis, and I am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and you are listening to Multifaithful, the podcast about religious, diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. On this week's podcast, I am joined by Rabbi Yehuda Sarna and Imam Khalid Latif, university chaplains at NYU, respective directors of the Bronfman Center for Jewish Student Life and the Islamic Center at NYU, and stars of the film Of Many, co-created and produced by Linda Mills and Chelsea Clinton. Also, as a side note, personal mentors to me as two of the people who first introduced me to multi-faith work when I was an undergrad at NYU. We talk about their own growth in the multi-faith world and their many projects that they work on together at NYU and why universities are an ideal place for multi-faith engagement. Thanks for listening to Multifaithful, and now to this week's conversation. I am joined today by Rabbi Yehuda Sarna and Imam Khalid Latif, university chaplains at NYU and stars of the film Of Many, a film about the friendship between a rabbi and an imam. Welcome.
Thank you.
So in the last year, you two have been going around the country quite a bit with this film Of Many, talking about interfaith and especially on college campuses. So I'm curious, with this kind of national perspective that you've gotten in the last, over the last year and a half, what are some of the biggest things you've learned, and what are some maybe challenges that the interfaith movement needs to start working on and doing a little bit more of going forward?
Well, I mean, I think it's fair to say, surprised by how well the film was received. And this was clearly an indication that people are hungry for this kind of conversation. I mean, I see it as a uniquely 21st century skill now that you have more and more cultures coming into contact with each other, more and more with greater frequency, where America is more diverse than it's ever been. You know, some scholars will call it a new religious America, the likes of which we've never seen before. And I think people really want to figure out how they can be rooted in their own identity, but still be very open and embracing of others, not in the sense of, oh, how can I tolerate someone despite our differences, but how can I harness the best of what I have and the best of what you have to create a mosaic or a richer society?
I think what was interesting to me was how many people who didn't have spirituality or religion as a very central variable to their identity felt connected to the film. And I think what it tells me is, you know, building off of this idea of it being a new religious America, is that there's still a lot of challenges and gaps, you know, on a national level, as well as in very kind of grassroots, localized efforts, just around really embracing diversity of any kind, and building actual harmonious living situations where people who are very distinct from each other can come together and not have just mere toleration, but acceptance and real celebration of people who are different from them. And so, you know, when we screened the film to diverse audiences or audiences that were more homogenous, so, you know, you had gatherings in New York City where people were coming from very different places, and then we were in parts of the United States where everyone was pretty much the same. You know, we had audiences that were all Protestant, they were all Catholic, they were all Caucasian, they were all college-age students. And yet you still found within those gatherings diversity, you know, through race, ethnicity, social class. And you can see that there is still a disconnect amongst individuals that I think on a macro level is something that becomes really problematic just in terms of how the society functions today. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think in the last year, probably the biggest area that's been popping up as an area around diversity that I think is in the news a lot has been around racial justice in the United States and the Black Lives Matter movement. So I'm curious, have you two seen anything particularly inspiring or maybe even uninspiring from the interfaith or religious community and how that community has responded to some of the challenges put forth by that movement?
I mean, I think there's a, we have to acknowledge that there's a certain degree of discontinuity between the work that's starting to emerge now on a grassroots level and the movement that was called the interfaith movement previously. The way religion is now structured in America, it's much, much less around doctrine. And therefore, the issues that are at stake are not a negotiation between the elders of one religion, the elders of another religion, getting together, saying, I'll cut out this line if you cut out that line, and then saying, okay, and now we can live with each other. People's identification with religion is much more individualized, and frankly, they just care less about what the people at the top are saying. The current pope enjoy such broad popularity, not because of a doctrinal change of this kind or the other kind, but because of his open style. So that's just to say that the individual and the very concrete communal aspects, I think, are the ones that are resonating. Therefore, I think the fundamental activity of, you know, what you'd call interfaith is not dialogue like it used to be, but it's the kind of activities which hasten or catalyze as many face-to-face interactions as possible. So it's not about sage on the stage anymore. It's about what's happening on the, to mix metaphors, it's about what's happening on the dance floor. And the more people we can get to work together on communal issues, advocate together, spend time in each other's homes, those are the features of what we're seeing that is developing nowadays.
I think you also see a magnification of faith being racialized, and I think a very, in my opinion, unfortunate divide building up between kind of a white versus non-white understanding of faith on a whole. And I wouldn't also just tie that to faith, but I would tie it to class, right? I think to see how all of these things kind of intertwine and really yield us kind of where we are today, it becomes problematic because you then find validation or justification of the mistreatment of minority groups in a disadvantageous way. But you also then find collaboration and coalition amongst certain minority groups to be able to kind of speak in a more amplified voice against certain oppressions and injustices that are becoming systemic, right? Like, you know, we are at a time right now where most candidates for the upcoming presidential election are talking about prison reform, right? Whereas that's never really happened before. And I would say that, yeah, people can be well-intentioned, but some of the realities that the conversations around race and ethnicity and Black Lives Matter has brought up around the treatment of African Americans in this country has compelled those conversations to start taking place and to realize what that means, not just in terms of the treatment of minorities, but the impact it would have on a privileged majority and really the amount of money that they're going to be making. And I think you see kind of a hesitancy at times on the part of faith-based movements and coalitions to talk to some of the other realities that we find today. And that's where, you know, having kind of a papal figure is a real interesting dynamic, because as much as you can have a tangential relationship with the religion, you still have a relationship that, with that individual potentially, that is based in something that's a little deeper, that can then create opportunity for you to think and reflect upon bigger issues in other ways, right? Like, I met the Pope when he was in New York, and it was really crazy for me to see, like, how much Catholic people really liked him, And that they were waiting to...
Not that anyone wouldn't like him.
Well, it's not that anyone... It's I really like him too. But I think, you know, it makes it unique. Like, he is a person, I think, transcends certain divides and impacts people with his messaging that are not even Catholic.
For sure.
I think Pope, just as an actual title or position, is something that even Catholics who have a very cursory relationship with their faith, you know, they still feel a connection to. And even if they don't practice or abide by the tenets or doctrines of their faith, they now have someone who says, this is what Catholicism says about X, Y, or Z thing. And it has, like, a certain trickle-down effect and impact. Whether they, you know, become active based off of that, you know, is a different question. And I think what you're seeing now is, like, a grassroots movement that is compelling conversation from, you know, bottom up as opposed to top down. And sometime when it turns into a minority-majority country, I think you're going to see religious groups, faith-based groups, playing that much more of a critical role in certain conversations that talk to, like, policy development.
Well, I mean, I think that there is something to... And this is, in a way, the other side of things. I felt over the past number of... maybe just the past year, 2 years... that, to get more specific about what you said about the racialization of religious identity, that Jews are increasingly being perceived as white, even though in the Jewish community there is a broad range of colors. There are Syrian Jews, Iranian Jews, Libyan Jews, Moroccan Jews. So in terms of skin color, all different colors. But increasingly, I found some students here at NYU, you know, people who are critical, for whatever reason, of the Jewish community, have referred to the community as like a white supremacist community. I mean, that's an extreme version. But I think people are increasingly, I just want to affirm what you're saying, people are increasingly kind of deciding, you know, are you white religion or you're a black religion? Mm-hmm. And the truth is that virtually every religion will have different stripes and colors.
Well, what we find, I mean, in the Muslim community, what you find is a lot of defamation, acts of vandalism, hate crimes, not only against Muslims, unfortunately, but against people who are Sikh, just because people can't
Hindus,
tell the difference.
Right.
But the distinction is what you find in large part on the Sikh community is they've never come out with statements that say, you know, don't do this to us, we're not Muslim, versus, you know, other groups that have said, you know, why are you doing this to us,
we're not
Muslim, right? But what the Sikh community has done, which I think is an embrace of diversity and pluralism in a way that needs to happen, is said that, you know, this shouldn't be happening to anybody. And that kind of persecution and that kind of ignorance and that kind of bigotry is something that's really problematic. And for a while, you saw it in really interesting frames, right? I remember there's a well-known supermodel. Her name is Tyra Banks, who used to have her own talk show. And she actually had guests on once where the frame of questionings for the audience was, I think, determining, you know, whether people were black, white, or Muslim. But they weren't even interjecting Islam as a faith. You know, it was just straight up seen as more of a racial category, you know, which kind of gives us an indication, right, of, you know, where I think we are more broadly as people and where it is that we need to kind of be moving forward towards, right? And then, you know, the value of, like, a film such as ours is that I think it allows for trends and themes to be understood that don't necessitate partners being religious figures only, but individuals who counter an antagonistic narrative that can be rooted in race, ethnicity, social class, you know, politics, whatever, and say that here's a different way of kind of looking at it. In large part, though, you know, that's not necessarily how society functions, right? Like, we're in a place where even many religious communities and religious groups function off of ideas of catering to specific segments, and I think benefit at times from those segments in ways that, to me, it's problematic because it takes away from the inclusivity that religious gatherings, in my opinion, should have and tend to be a little bit more exclusive, you know, where you have congregations that wouldn't be open to having diversity there. Because that's just not what the person's comfortable with.
Look, I think that's one of the things that you've done and you've navigated really, really well is how to build an Islamic center with so many different kinds of kind of Muslim persuasion, right? You have people who are part of, whether it's Sunni, Shia, or in a certain part of the world, right, there's, they're fighting each other. And, but somehow in the Islamic center, they, you know, by the hundreds, people come together and pray. I mean, how do you do that?
I don't know. But yeah, I think though it's a challenge, right? Because you can go.
It's the food.
You can go into a lot of mosques.
It's all about the fried chicken Fridays.
Right? Yeah, but you go into a lot of mosques, you go into a lot of churches, you go into a lot of synagogues, a lot of temples. I mean, then they're not diverse, but they could be. And, you know, one could say, oh, it's just a product of the people who live in the area or they frequent that congregation. But, you know, in a very real way, it would be at times abnormal or awkward for not even someone from outside of the faith to be in the space, but someone who is not of a specific race or ethnicity or social class to now be in a space that the other kind of embodies. And I think that's really how most of our institutions are set up, right? And that's how many apparatus, you know, religious and otherwise in the country are set up. And I think why it functions differently at a university is because you have kids who are going through this formative period of their identity. And I think class plays a big part of determining friend circles, but, you know, not in the same way, right? Like, I could go to a Shabbat service at a university, whether I'm wealthy or not, right? And I could go to a Friday Jummah prayer, whether I'm wealthy or not. But it doesn't work the same way when I've now, like, left from the university apparatus. And I think that's why it's so critical to take advantage of university settings and, you know, at a time when many universities are becoming more and more secularized, NYU is uniquely embracing spiritual diversity and religious diversity. I think, one, it creates an entry point for people of their own faith persuasions to now deal with people who are of a similar faith-based background that they would normally not in their own houses of worship or congregations outside of the university. And then two, they start to now engage with people who are of different backgrounds, which they may or may not see happening. And they start to then reinvent, like, hey, what is, like, a real Muslim congregation look like? Or a real Jewish congregation? Or a real Christian congregation that functions off of a paradigm of divine gatherings that look to be inclusive rather than exclusive. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and there's a great irony to that. I think that we live in the most diverse, one of the most diverse societies on the face of this planet, and yet increasingly through public perception, people are seeing black and white.
Mm-hmm. When I went to Holland a few years ago, you know, they have a large Dutch native population, and however many decades ago they brought a lot of Turks and Moroccans in to do kind of the blue-collar work that the native population didn't want to do, with an understanding that they would probably go back home after everything was done. So the ditch diggers, construction workers, all these types of people. None of those people
left. Right, because why would they stay?
Why would they stay?
Just because they have a job.
They had families, you know, and the processes of gentrification, as well as conversation around race and ethnicity, wasn't something that those populations ever had. Why were they thinking those ways? But to speak to your point, what was really interesting was the schools that had a larger population of non-Dutch immigrants, Turks and Moroccans, were called the black schools. And, you know, in turn, the ones that were predominantly Dutch were the non-black schools, the white schools. And when I sat down and I was talking to, like, the people in the municipalities or even the people who were Turks and Moroccans, I was like, don't you see what the problem is here? they're like, no, we don't see what the problem is here. Like, it just kind of, you know, went over their head. But it's not even localized to the United States. Like, I mean, everywhere you kind of see it as a phenomenon, right? And I think that's why a Black Lives Matter movement is so important to really understand what it's speaking to. And what does it mean when someone who's part of the Black Lives Matter movement is talking about challenging a white supremacy, not to cause discomfort to people who are white and look at it just in terms of individual interactions, but beyond microaggressions, really seeing institutionally what that means and how it's been very pervasive, like on a global level, you know? And I think faith-based organizations can actually play a really interesting role in remedying some of these things.
You know, it's interesting for the high holidays that just were. One of the sermons that was delivered in one of our services really focused on the Black Lives Matter movement and about institutional oppression and what does it mean to participate in those institutions which and not protest that kind of oppression. And one of the rabbis who delivered one of these sermons said that afterwards a student came over to her and said, I was very uncomfortable by your sermon because I felt like you were calling me racist. And the rabbi responded saying, well, that, you know, did that make you feel uncomfortable? Because to a certain extent, maybe you are. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, it, sometimes, you know, they say that the role of a religious leader is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. I don't believe in naming things, like naming a particular problem just to be able to say, okay, we've named it, now let's move on. But I do think that naming something is an essential step in trying to remedy it. But you don't get points just for naming it.
Yeah.
So can I follow up on that? Because this is something that I work on a lot here and struggle with a lot here is in a Jewish community, as we're both Jewish, that is often considered or conflated.
Khaled's not Jewish.
Khaled's not Jewish. That's often conflated and combined.
We're working on it.
I think that would pretty much undo everything from that film. That is conflated and considered to be white in the United States a lot of the time. Are there particular challenges for the Jewish community for embracing some of these issues that maybe we're lagging behind on and maybe as part of an interfaith movement we need to be more vocal on?
Look, I think it's fair to say European Jews who immigrated to the United States fought hard to become white. Meaning, there was when they came here, many of them changed their names so that they would sound more American and sometimes
more... My family
more
did that.
...Christian, right? Ariel, your family's name was...
It was like Innstein or Einstein.
Exactly.
Now it's Ennis.
Ennis, which rhymes with tennis. Now, what could be more white than tennis? So I think that it does present a certain difficulty. One of the reasons I would say that in the 60s the Jewish community was so involved in the civil rights movement is at a time when there still was institutionalized anti-Semitism, there still were clubs or places or towns or real estate that Jews could not gain access to. The feeling in the Jewish community was, well, if we can get the blacks to be equal, then we would be equal also. As a professor here, Chassid Einar, said, one of the exciting things about America for European Jews is that when Jews came to this country, the turn of the 20th century, they were second-class citizens, which for what America was and for when they were coming from, was not all that bad. And I think if we look at the Black Lives Matter movement, I think there was a voice of conscience in the Jewish community which was supportive and active, though I would say if you compare that to the involvement of the Jewish community during the Civil Rights Movement...
It's nowhere near.
Nowhere near what the involvement was in the Civil Rights Movement.
college. So can you maybe give us some insight into how some of these issues play out for the American Muslim community, in a community that is a little bit newer than the Jewish community to the United States and is maybe earlier on in its struggle for civil rights or equality here?
You know, the Muslim community in the United States has been here for a really long time. Islam, you know, has been here with slaves that were brought here during the slave trade. I mean, you have mosques in this country that have been here since the 1800s. So the concept that Islam is something new or is from something from elsewhere is problematic in and of itself. I think the challenge that Muslims run into is that the larger populations of Muslims in the country are this indigenized population that is an African-American, Latino population that, you know, is definitely not building itself in a post-race America. There's still a lot of disenfranchisement. We see, even beyond the civil rights movement, the way black people are treated in the country these days. Then you have a large immigrant population that has been coming here for quite some time, but a large influx, you know, in the last 50 years or so, that in and of itself has existed also at the fringes of society. And movement now towards ideas of how do you really empowerment through institutional development and growth. I mean, I don't think the narrative has to be victimized, but if it is, I don't think it's problematic. You know, the unfortunate realities and treatments of Muslims in the United States is something that is pretty clear. A deep rise in anti-Muslim, Islamophobic sentiment, hate crimes being a regular occurrence. Aside, you know, you have institutionalized policy, whether that's in the frame of domestic or international security policy, scrutinization of charitable giving, protests and yielding to protests of the construction of mosques. I mean, even as, you know, there's movement towards a presidential campaign, you have people who are vying for the office of president of the United States that have very major points to their political platform being
Muslims cannot be president.
Muslims, right? And it makes you really wonder, like, where we are as a country and how those are things that are seen as acceptable and okay. But I think the geopolitical realities that we find, you know, internationally, our country's foreign policy and, you know, some of the unfortunate consequences of that yield kind of this narrative that equates Islam to what it is. And then allows for people who are just living day to day to think of Muslims in the way that they do.
We have a little bit more time, so just a question that a little bit changes the subject, but both of you in your role as chaplains and as a rabbi and an imam have put a significant amount of your energy into interfaith and multi-faith, into not only working with your community but reaching out to others. So how has that changed you, Rabbi Sarna, as a Jew? And how has that changed you, Khalid, as a Muslim? How has that changed your own identity and then how you've kind of reflect back on maybe your own community?
I think that the interfaith engagement that I've had has enabled me to access a different kind of caring or compassion than I'd experienced previously. I think one way to think about compassion is that it's normal and natural to be compassionate about, or to care about oneself, and by extension one's family, by extension one's friends, and by extension one's community. But it's another to say, you know, not necessarily starting from that, from those emerging concentric circles, but just to say, if someone is a human being, then I care about them. And look, I went through many of the same things that many people do, you know, struck by some of the similarities, some of the quirky similarities, I mean, of different religious groups. On a deeper level, struck by the similarities in the kinds of struggles that individuals would go through. Now we're obviously in an educator role, so creating those contexts where people will actually, where we know the stages or the that people will go through, the questions that they'll be asking. But all the while, I think what surprised me in a way is that it has not led in any way to a watering down or a thinning out of my own religious identity.
You know, I think in trying to assess like what it just means to be good, being able to interact with people in day-to-day interactions, but also in, you know, moments has really helped me to kind of shape for myself certain values and ideals. So in, you know, I think in the last 8 or 9 years that Rabbi Sarna and I have known each other, I think it's made me think a lot about what it means to like serve a community and what it means to be like a husband and what it means to be a father and what selflessness means. But, you know, I sat next to Pope Francis when he was in New York and just got to really like think about what that meant now in terms of somebody who, no offense, like operates at a much bigger level. Than we do. He had spoken at a cathedral the night before our interfaith memorial at the Ground Zero site, and you literally had like people who were lined up for like 8 or 9 hours just sitting and standing waiting to see this man. And for many, they would consider it to be the highlight of their life. He walked by me and, you know, wow, I got to just see him. And we went to that cathedral. You know, he's probably very acutely aware of whatever he said would be something that people would absorb and just really try to understand as best as they could. And so he's there now in this church talking to a room full of Catholics, and he goes off script. And the first thing he says is a prayer for Muslims who died in Mecca that day on a stampede in the Hajj. And it made me really think, like, why would he do that, right? Like, he gets nothing from it. He's in a city that has been accused of surveilling Muslims, that is in a post-9/11 climate, that is dealing with its own issues around race and ethnicity and class, that has seen people protest the construction of mosques. And he's talking to arguably probably a predominantly Catholic audience in a church that has sat there and waited for him for hours. And he still thinks it's important to tell them that. It made me really think, you know, in the couple of months leading into that gathering, I had so many people who were like, oh, that's so, you know, you're so lucky, you're going to be sitting next to the Pope, this and that, whatever. And even if it was something that was subtle, you know, my mindset and my intention was one that was more so like, wow, like, I'm going to be sitting next to him. As opposed to, like, later on, a transition that came in that said, hey, like, how is that as a moment something that can really bring healing and benefit, like, people, right? But my first instinct was to think about, look at where I will be, as opposed to thinking, you know, where that being will be something that really brings positivity to others. And I was just, you know, I was thinking about it in terms of, this guy runs around all day and all night, you know, he's almost 80 years old, like, what compels him and motivates him? And I think the challenge of being able to have moments of introspection like that become quite rare when you're only talking to people who are just like you, that don't challenge you to really think about yourself like through them, and to really assess your values and your ideals in ways where you don't have to be self-deprecating, but you can acknowledge where you have strengths as well as you have non-strengths. And I think the work that I'm blessed to do with Rabbi Yehuda Sarna, you know, has been eye-opening for me, And arguably, it's probably like not even just like an interfaith relationship or like a professional relationship, but probably one of the few relationships I've had in my life that have lasted this long outside of family.
It's true.
You know,
it's true.
I mean, my wife and I have been married for a lesser number of years than, you know, our friendship has been. But I really think, you know, there's certain opportunities that have been yielded to me for growth that I wouldn't have had, like if I didn't have that as something that I sought to take advantage of actively. You know what I mean?
Totally. That's a great, no, it absolutely makes sense. Maybe we'll one day we'll get the Pope for an interview and we can ask him about it. Ask him what his thought process was when he gave that speech. All right, Khaled, I know you have to go, so thank you to both of you for joining us. Always a pleasure. I know I get to talk to you during our weekly staff meetings every week, but always fun to talk about non-programmatic things that have to get done and just talk in theory. So thanks for coming. Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. Especially like to thank our guests, Rabbi Yehuda Sarna and Imam Khaled Latif. Special thanks to everyone in the office who helped with this podcast. Special thank you to Brian Young once again for editing and producing the podcast. And to Liz Suados for the music, which is originally from the Of Many film, which is starring Rabbi Yehuda Sarna and Imam Khaled Latif. If you haven't seen it yet, email spiritual.life@nyu.edu for a copy. Also, same email address if you have any feedback, thoughts, comments, suggestions, or have someone you think should appear on the podcast. We'd love to have them. Please rate and review us on iTunes, and we hope to see you again in a future episode.